Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Dr. Nick Begets, the author with Gene Manning of Angels Don't Play This Harp, subtitled Advances in Tesla Technology, published in softcover by the Earth Pulse Press, copyright 1995. Dr. Begets, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Well, it's good to be back with you.
Now, you are discontinuing your active work on Project HARP, and among the things that is alarming about this military system are some of the possible, and again, let me stress the use of the term possible, unintended side effects. One of the things that you discuss in Angels Don't Play This HARP is the theorized possibility, and again, let me stress the word possibility, that pumping all kinds of electromagnetic radiation into the atmosphere could ultimately lead to a short circuit between the sun and the Earth with disastrous results for the Earth. Or not a short circuit between the sun, but a short circuit between the atmosphere and the Earth, in particular if there was a solar storm.
Yeah, there was the idea of the HARP facility or a facility like it acting as a shunt or a conduit by which electrical potentials could be transferred from, say, the ionosphere down to the Earth was raised in the context of a worst-case scenario, again, by Brooks Agnew. And what he suggested would be visualized there would be like the biggest bolt of lightning you ever seen striking the Earth 40 times a second until the energy was discharged. There's a tremendous amount of energy in the ionosphere, and the idea that this system on the ground, although small in comparison, has the ability to manipulate or cause that ionosphere to behave in a much different way, following basically the rules of geophysics and electronics.
It is also theorized that among the possible unintended side effects would be that the use of the HARP system could slow the Earth's rotation with disastrous results.
You know, that comes up, and we touch on it a little bit in the book in terms of pointing to a couple references to the idea the Earth is slowing and that it's essentially a big electromagnetic dynamo in terms of how it functions, and that these interactions with those magnetic fields could create problems that result in such an event is certainly out there. But I think the greater possibilities are triggering geophysical movement, great possibilities at the weather anomalies as just an unintended side effect is going to happen, period. Just by heating the ionosphere, you create a change in pressure systems over that area, which immediately affects surrounding areas and begin to affect weather systems on a larger scale as that chain reacts, because these systems are open and connected. They're not isolated, running in a vacuum in some lab somewhere.
Another possible unintended side effect you discuss, and again, I want to stress that you don't say this would happen, but some of the experts in this field are afraid of the possibility
that this might happen.
That concerns the possible shifting of the Earth's magnetic pole, something that has happened in the past and apparently has fairly catastrophic results on the surface of the Earth.
This is real true. In fact, when you think about it, there was a gentleman by the name of Hapsgood, and I believe we cite his work in the context of our writing, but he basically showed where the pole has shifted four times in the last 100,000 years, which in geologic time isn't a very great deal of time at all. The idea that the Earth periodically shifts is well known. I mean, there's no doubt about it. We're not talking about a total reversal here, but just a shift where it moves from its present location to a new location hundreds, perhaps even thousands of miles away. It has done that four times in the last 100,000 years. In what we see right now, and there's been some people raising this issue, is just the whole climate change configuration causes a changing in terms of the basic weight of the planet and distribution of that weight, and the planet wobbles naturally, and then you add into that this electric dynamo effect that the planet actually creates, and you're manipulating then those magnetic field lines. It's difficult to say what could happen. If you're already at a point where another straw is the straw that breaks the camel's back, and certainly the Earth is demonstrating a lot of instabilities in terms of weather patterns, earthquake patterns, in terms of intensity, frequency, and depth. All the statistical models showing changes within the planet show that there's a very steep curve. What we don't know is whether that's a natural oscillation in what happens in the Earth's long cycle or whether it's something that we should be concerned about. And from our perspective, at least, it's certainly something we need to be cautious about, and these new weapon systems aren't something to introduce to an already highly destabilized system, at least from what we can, you know, what we can see.
Now, let me also stress to the audience that some of the things we may be talking about, both the intended effects of this weapon system and some of the possible unintended side effects will hover, I think, at the very margin of people's consciousnesses. And yet, there is ample documentation for these things. And to my way of thinking, that is the single most important aspect of your work, Dr. Begich, is that you have laid these things out and made the incredible seem... seem tangible to the uninitiated.
Yeah, you know, that was the whole point, is we took the military's record and the public record and put it in a form where people could read it and understand it. And what we found in disclosing HAARP was really the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there is a tremendous amount of data that we've built over the last 4 years dealing with weapons technologies and their developments. And there are things that are not making it into the general public debate that quite frankly should. And what HAARP has done is provide a backdrop and an opportunity to bring those issues to policymakers at a time when I think there actually is still a chance of changing the direction of some of this technology.
Now, you spoke about bringing this to the attention of policymakers. Indeed, one of the things that has no doubt drawn the ire of the powers that be in this country is the work of you and your co-workers in front of the European Parliament.
Yeah, that's true. And that was the building of a coalition, because we built support from conservatives, Social Democrats, Greens, and others representing the major political factions in Europe around this issue. And we did it with a series of 8 trips to Europe, building good relationships with parliamentarians. And all of that work was really facilitated by those who supported our work here in the United States, which was essentially people who heard about us and supported us in the form of purchasing our books and giving us airtime on the issue. But the fact is, it demonstrates again, because the very reason we ended up in Parliament was somebody on a radio program actually heard what we were saying, passed material on, it got into the hands of a parliamentarian, Tom Spencer, who at that time was chairing the Environmental Committee, was a conservative from Great Britain, and he later then became chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, which was just real fortuitous in the sense that it was at the time when he had confirmed for himself the validity of what we were asserting, and you know, began to facilitate the right kinds of connections to make that possible. So it's been a long 4 years, but that was one of the primary goals we had going in, was to get elected parliamentarians or legislators to begin to look at this issue.
And that has happened in Europe. So far, not in the United States.
No, not in the U.S. You know, the other thing that did happen in Europe, and one of the other things we tried to achieve, and we even mentioned this in the last chapter of our book, was independent review to confirm the science. And in Brussels, a group called GRIP has done that. In fact, the study they did won the Philip Bordeaux Award for reporting, because it was just a really well-received award by the from the University of Brussels. And then from that, the European Parliament intends to do an additional study on HAARP and make that widely available, which will set the context for putting pressure, political pressure, on the U.S. side of the equation. So that debate is going to happen. I mean, it's just going to happen as the outgrowth of what's been achieved. And so, you know, I think it's on the way. And we felt from the beginning that would be the only way that it would occur, is if we could show that the U.S. wasn't credible in their defense policy as they were articulating it. And we demonstrated that in February. We talked about the deployment of ICBM system here, for instance, in violation of the ABM treaty. And that has actually occurred in the last 10 months since we were there. And, you know, at this point, I think there's enough awareness as to what we brought forward that there's a lot more listening on the part of what activists have a potential of presenting, if well documented, than it was even a few years ago.
The two things that alarmed me most when I read the book, first of all, some of the unintended possible side effects, which could lead to the destruction of the Earth, conceivably, quite by accident, which is distasteful enough. But aside from that, these weapon systems could, in theory, be used on the American population, and you discuss that in Angels Don't Play This HAARP.
Yeah, the idea that non-lethal weapons technologies would be deployed on civilian populations shouldn't be too difficult to grasp. I mean, certainly, you know, that possibility is there. But more than that is there's actually a policy in place between the Department of Justice and Department of Defense to transfer non-lethal technologies for civilian use. And civilian use of non-lethal technologies, or any technologies for that matter, within the boundaries of a sovereign country, are usually excluded under international agreements. In fact, are under most of our international agreements. So these things are not only likely to occur, but there's policy in place to allow the use of these systems, and they're more likely to occur on the basis that it's less distasteful in the eyes of most people to do something non-lethal than something lethal to your own citizenry. And I think that's, again, the big caution point is at what point are weapons not deployed because they're just flat not acceptable to human values, and at what point are they deployed? And these are the real questions behind all of these technologies.
What is the current status of HAARP and related technologies? Now, we're speaking now in January of 1999. Originally, HAARP was scheduled to come online last year, was it not?
Yeah, and they've delayed a couple of years in terms of their finishing their first phase, but it's received $110 million in direct funding. Additional funding has been appropriated for this coming year. Essentially, they're on, you know, from their perspective, on track for a lot of it. They were delayed, I think, at least a year because of our effort. Maybe even longer. There's a lot more caution in how they're approaching it, at least here in Alaska. I think that what we'll most likely see is the deployment of systems that have already built and are capitalizing on what's been learned in HAARP. And I think that's part of what this Super Darn system that they're deploying in Canada, Europe, and in Alaska is part of that outgrowth.
That's called Super Darn. Is that D-A-R-N?
Yes, and this is a new initiative for X-band radar, which is part of this ICBM interceptor system. And what people don't realize is the U.S. government already spent $3.7 billion on a system last year in last year's appropriation, even though the development of such a system violates treaties with the former Soviet Union. And this is, again, you know, where we're headed in all of this. Even this next week, Albright is supposed to be in Russia to tell the Russians that we're going to deploy this whether we get an amendment or not. That's important policy, because how that affects the rest of the world is really the issue, because those old agreements for many countries represent a stabilizing agreement that they look towards creating what people have thought would happen is some kind of a peace dividend after the Cold War ended. And really what we're seeing is a shift in technology that's causing a different kind of arms race, but perhaps maybe even a more disturbing kind of an arms race.
What is the current status of political activity? I know you've mentioned that the European Parliament is looking into this. Do you anticipate, or are there any indications of any other type of political activity vis-a-vis HAARP?
Yeah, I think I know that Tom Spencer, as chair of foreign affairs, has an interest in coming here perhaps as early as March. I think that what we'll see is some policy initiatives in terms of treaty initiatives coming from the Europeans. That will be wide-reaching in terms of their implications for these systems. I don't think they'll just be addressing HAARP technologies, but they'll also be addressing some of the more exotic new weaponry. And I think that's really the big gain, because we had always hoped that HAARP would be a place for people to focus attention, but then to begin to look at what else is in this new specter of weapon systems and address it as a whole, because piecemealing it is not the approach. And these are quite invasive technologies, the kinds of technology I think most people, if they think about it very long, would certainly oppose tampering with and playing games with. And we don't need them, number one. And number two, they can be avoided. And number three, they can be easily detected if anyone's using them. So, I mean, it's not something that one country can do and no one else gets to find out about. We're all sophisticated enough to understand what they are and how they work and measure anyone that's possibly using them, utilizing our satellite-based technologies.
And let me stress again that it is at least theoretically possible that these technologies, some or all, could be used in the United States. That's one of the points you make. In the event, say, of an economic collapse and widespread social and political dislocation, this could be the final solution to social troubles in the United States.
Well, look at it from this standpoint. Already in police forces, they have electric batons. They have tasers. They have weapons that are being developed that will knock out electronic ignitions on automobiles, causing them to stop. They have electronic bracelets for prisoners. I mean, the idea of introducing electronics to law enforcement isn't a big leap. It's the more sophisticated the tool, there's a big transition, and it happens very rapidly. Monitoring equipment, as another example, in nano and micro technologies, they believe they can monitor complete inner cities and eventually perhaps even countries or war zones using cameras, surveillance equipment, microphones, and the like. These are all the outgrowths of our technology, but the questions that must be raised are the same ones raised a couple hundred years ago, dealing with individual privacy, freedom and movement and the exchange or the cost of having those freedoms against safety and security. And that's the balancing act that really needs to be better applied as we go through developing technologies and making sure that our ethical debate on those technologies parallels their development.
Nick, we've got about 10 minutes left in the interview before I want to repeat the information about where to get Angels Don't Play This Harp, about Spitfire, etc. Since this will be, in all probability, our last interview on the subject, what would you like to say to the audience, either by way of review or by way of encouragement or philosophizing, free form for the last 10 minutes? What would you like to speak with the audience about?
Well, you know, I think the biggest lesson for me personally and for a lot of us that got involved in this issue is the ability of moving public policy is within the capability of most people. And it requires some effort and some energy, and I think everyone has some part to play in that, no matter how significant or insignificant they might think that act is or that move is. But I think that's the biggest lesson, and not doing it in the traditional way of organizing, but making sure you're providing good information, well-documented, and that you're pressing that information in front of the public in the forums that you're provided. And I think that's the big lesson learned, is that's still possible. On this issue, for us, it has been a major issue, and at the time in which we're moving on to other things, we really feel the work's been accomplished, and that we have a capability of doing that in other areas, and everyone has that capability in doing it at a local, state, national, and even, as we've shown, on an international level.
One of the things that's been disturbing to me, Nick, has been the relative lack of publicity here in the United States outside of one or two radio shows. One hears almost nothing about it in the U.S.
Well, I think that's changing a little bit. I know one of the really good BBC segments was that we had done a couple years ago was actually played recently by A&E, which is starting to, you know, work its way into that mainstream mindset. And I think in the next year, as the international debate grows on this, it'll come back. Only it will come back in a form where independent studies, independent of us, will be the ones behind that move. And I think that's, you know, the appropriate handoff. I mean, they have the resources and the means to make sure that the debate takes place. And for our role, we'll continue to work with parliamentarians. We'll continue to work providing source materials from our data files as they're needed. And I think that's a good role for us as an activist publisher to play at this point, having, you know, taken the issue to the point in which a private person really can. And I think that's the recognition that we've come to is it's really time. And Gail was right. You know, when Gail suggested it was time to move on for lots of reasons, the overriding reason is there comes a point where it is, you're done. You've done what you can do on that issue, and it's time to, you know, hand it off and make sure that, you know, whatever follow-up is needed, you know, is pretty much in place. I mean, that's there. So we feel real good about that.
Indeed. With regard to what the average individual listener could do, what suggestions would you make?
A couple things. Firstly, on this issue, certainly get hold of congressional delegations and let them know that you're concerned about the development of new weaponry. And its implications, and that there ought to be more wide discussion of what those systems involve, and be specific about the kinds of concerns that you have. And I think on the other side of it, in just general political organizing, we have a website I used, and it's just political essays, but there's one called Change Agents and Reality Creation, and it's at www.nickbegich.org.
One more time slowly, Dr. Begich, for people who are writing this down.
Okay, it's www.nickbegich.org. And that website has a series of political essays, things that I've written over the last couple of years. But there's one, Change Agents and Reality Creation, which is really a roadmap for activists at a local level on a matrix you can follow for creating change on any given issue within a community and expanding that to any degree that you want. And, you know, we did a lot of things in the course of HARP in trying to define not just this issue, but the mechanism we used for trying to resolve the problem. So I think those writings would be quite useful to people interested in pursuing similar work.
This is a subject which is so scary that psychologically, contemplating technologies of this kind can be very, very defeating, I think, for the average listener. And I speak as one who found this pretty depressing, and I've spent my life researching depressing information. what would you recommend to the average American, or Mr. and Mrs. American, all the ships at sea, about how to overcome the inevitable depression, I think, that comes from the recognition of the realities that you discuss, and how to transform that attitude into political action and a more positive approach?
Sure. That's really an important point, and one well worth talking about. And I think we talk a lot in detail in some of the other essays that are on that site, but the thing I would say is taking on things that are within your capability is the first rule of thumb, because if you take on something that is not really feasible or something that you can't believe you can solve, that's where you result in frustration and a sense of hopelessness. And I think you do what's in front of you. And I think each person has something in front of them that they can do, whether it's talking to a neighbor or whether it's more involved than that. And I think that's all that's ever required. But having knowledge and then acting on that knowledge really does dissipate a good degree of that sense of hopelessness, because it's something you can do. And on the other side of it is recognizing that there's hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people on any given issue doing the same thing. That's at least the approach we took. I mean, our whole intent was to catalyze interest in this issue to the point where people became their own activists, and we've done that. We triggered enough interest by the right people to cause them to pursue it on their own and carry work on. And that's really I think that's really what it's about. But each person that has done something that's interconnected with the work of a lot of others in what may be termed best an organic internet. It's not connected formally, but it is. And I think that's what we've seen happen here. And that's how we maintain our sense of balance in all of this.
A lot of people have told me over the years that they've tried to relay information and found it very hard to get through to some people. On an individual basis, that can be the case, and yet at the same time, I've had the experience many times of presenting information to people that were not aware of it, and simply informing them of the facts can have a profound and transforming effect on individuals.
Absolutely. And once people know, what happens is the normal reactions for information or change is certainly you don't want it, you don't want to make the change, so there's a certain amount of resistance, and there's a certain level of fear. You pass through that pretty quickly, and then you start to sense, all right, if these things are possible, then what are the mechanisms by which the direction of this stuff changes? And there are directions, and there are things that can be done. And it may be easier now than before, in the sense that it is easier to reach out and communicate issues. And I think the big thing is to make sure everything is well documented and stick to your documents. With HARP, there's been lots of speculation over the years that hasn't been supported by good documents. And in those senses, we've stayed away from them. But at the same time, we haven't ignored some of the more esoteric potentials with the science, because you can't ignore all the possibilities until you've eliminated them by good science. And our concern is that right now the science says we're right, and the issues we've raised are the kinds of issues that say to the military it's not time to move forward on this.
Again, people should not underestimate, even though it can be very frustrating trying to talk to someone who is recalcitrant. There's an old Chinese expression, never attempt to teach a pig to sing, it'll frustrate you and annoy the pig, you know?
the other thing is, too, is, once they then start to see it come out in the mainstream, they remember those conversations, and that adds a lot of strength then to future support for the issues.
So and the flip side is, too, that, all right, if you're going to try to teach a pig to sing, it will be frustrating for you and annoying for the pig. On the other hand, there are people out there who do want information, and many times I've been written to by people who had their entire political outlook galvanized by information and altered fundamentally by information that they had heard on one or another broadcast. That's not in any way to blow my own horn, but rather to stress that as a paradigm, the communication of accurate and important information is incalculably important. In fact, tyrannies, whether of the left or the right, or even of a monarchical, even absolute monarchy could... they place an emphasis on the control of information, censoring the press, controlling the journalistic process, whether through editorial or through pure terror. The killing of journalists is absolutely paramount for tyrannies of any stripe, and that is because of the potentially transforming power of information.
You know, it's interesting, is one of the things in the very end of our work last year, we ran across a document prepared by the military creating villains out of what used to be just called investigative researchers. They gave them the title accumulators, and actually talk about the risks that people such as myself, who are out there doing investigative work and putting the story together, presenting a different kind of security risk for the military establishment, because you can put the stories together today much easier than you could in the past. And yet, again, it gets to the question of what's the security risk, and we wrestle with this all the time, and what is legitimately a public issue to be debated. And I think what we come down to is, don't tell people how to build these systems, but at least discuss their implications. And that, I think, is legitimately always a matter of public discussion.
Absolutely. One thing that has been very frustrating to me is to see the type of work that you've engaged in and so many others have dismissed by the so-called progressive sector, and note my use of the term so-called, as conspiracy theory, which, whether intended or otherwise, and I think a lot of it is deliberately generated by the intelligence community, has the effect of censoring and destroying this kind of work and playing right into the hands of those who deem this type of work to be a threat.
That can happen, and I think care has to be taken in how you disclose and how you carry your information out. But the biggest care is stick to the facts. And if you do that, and I think if you footnote your material well and you present these source documents when they're needed, it does have a tremendous effect. At the same time, the realization that the establishment will try and assassinate you either first by character or otherwise is certainly a possibility. But once you're out there and once you're delivering information, it's your own insurance policy in a sense, because you've done what others didn't think was possible. At the same time, you've gotten support at that point by those who've reviewed your work, if you've done it well and you've done it carefully. At least that's our experience.
Indeed. Dr. Begich, in our last couple of minutes here, why don't you repeat slowly and a couple of times the information about where they can get the book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, mailing address, phone and fax, and website, etc.
The phone number is 888-690-1277.
That's 888-690-1277.
And the website for our work is www.earthpulse.com. Or www.nickbegich.org for political information.
All righty, and repeat one more time the website.
www.earthpulse.com or www.nickbegich.org.
And the mailing address for Earth Pulse Press, for people that don't have computers, and there are a lot of people who don't, Earth Pulse Press, P.O. Box 201393, that's 201393, Anchorage, Alaska. By the way, that's abbreviated A-K, is it?
Yes.
Okay, Anchorage, Alaska, A-K, 99520, USA. Once again, Earth Pulse Press, P.O. Box 21393, Anchorage, Alaska, 99520, USA. And the four previous interviews, as well as this interview with Dr. Nick Begich, can be obtained from Spitfire. That's one word, Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005, email address spitfire@ix.netcom.com. Dr. Begich, let me thank you once again from the bottom of my heart for your work, because it is absolutely necessary.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate the time today with you guys in California.
And for Dr. Nick Begich, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.